first point of contact that I tend to have is like what everybody does, Google. You know, I think Google has its values. It's not the best resource, but it sort of gives you a good outline and sort of a good start. And then after that, I tend to go to the scriptures, the suttas, and they're available, whatever publications, whether it's the Nikayas or the Agamas, you can find them online, you can find them through books. And then, so I like to quote from those suttas, because essentially those are the Buddha's words, those are what he has taught in, you know, when he was alive, and that's what has been passed down. So when I approached this topic, I kind of asked the question, what exactly is refuge? Because I think if we want to talk about the topic, we kind of have to understand what the topic is asking. What's the question, right? So in my line of work, I always ask, like, you know, what's your question? Then I can answer your question. So it becomes a habit. So I think, you know, what's your understanding of refuge?
I must assume that you're already in misery.
Yeah, I think that's a good start. So when I sort of looked into the definition of refuge, and I found that there's actually two parts to it, which is, one, you have to see that there is a problem in order to seek refuge, because then you want a solution to the problem. But anyways, as my starting point, I Google definition of refuge. And according to Google Dictionary, it says it's the state of being safe or sheltered from pursuit, danger, or difficulty. So, you know, it's a sense of you want to be safe from a problem. You want to be safe from difficulties, from unease, from... you know, from something that makes you unhappy, right? And similarly, I always check for two reference points just in case Google is biased. And so the Cambridge Dictionary gave a very similar definition, so I think we're safe. You know, Cambridge says, a place that gives protection or shelter from danger, trouble, unhappiness, etc. So I think we can quite safely say that, you know, the definition of refuge, kind of, you want to be aware, you want to be sheltered, you want to be safe from all the negative states of beings, you know, from danger, trouble, unhappiness, unsatisfactoriness, unease, etc., etc., etc. So we're clear on that, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, good. So, but you see, the thing is, in order to seek refuge, you first, like you say, you have to recognize that there is a problem. If there is no problem, there is no need to seek refuge, right? Like, you know, and I think it's something that's very fundamental to the core of Buddhism, which I like to refer to the really one of the core teachings of Buddhism, which is the Four Noble Truths. Now, most of you here been to many, many, many Dharma talks. So I am sure all of you can tell me what is the Four Noble Truths. Don't be shy. Ah, that's right. Not too long ago, you and
I. But it's a fair.
So this is a test of how many of you actually went and actually participated and understood. I know who to ask if I'm, because I saw you guys at the store. Manning the store, manning the games, giving out chocolates. Yeah, it has to be you. So what are the Four Noble Truths?
The first one is suffering.
Mm.
The second one is the cause of suffering.
Mm.
The third one is the end of suffering.
Correct.
And the last one is the path.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. Right. Yes, correct. Correct. And I think the Buddha is very wise in that when he was teaching about the Four Noble Truths, the first truth is there is suffering. Or rather, I usually prefer the translation of from dukkha, which is the Pali word, to unsatisfactoriness. Just because I think it captures a bit more of what that word entails. Because it's not always, you know, I mean, suffering is, I mean, we're speaking in English, so it has to be an English equivalent. And I think sometimes suffering brings up the idea that you're constantly in pain, you're in agony, but it's not just that. You know, there are, it's a whole spectrum of things, from the very subtle to the very, you know, the very blunt and obvious, right? So, I mean, we have to recognize that there is suffering or dissatisfaction, right? Because otherwise, you know, we get on with our lives, there's no problems, why bother seeking refuge at all? You know? So, and this is something that I think we have to look very deep in ourselves. What is our dissatisfaction? Because then, can we then begin the journey to seek a solution to this dissatisfaction or suffering? And I think the Buddha is very wise in saying that, you know, he recognizes that there is this dissatisfaction. But then he also said in the second truth that there is a cause to this dissatisfaction and suffering, right? So because there is cause, and then it's got an effect, right? But further on to that, the third truth says that there is an end to suffering. So, you know, we know that there is suffering or dissatisfaction. We know there's a cause. But there's no point talking about it if there is no end to it. Like, yeah, we can talk about it, but it's never going to change, so why bother talking about it? Right? So the third truth is important because there is actually an end. There is, it can be ended. Right? And then, he didn't just leave us hanging at that. Yeah, it can be ended. Bye-bye. He goes on to say, there is a way to end it. There is the path to end suffering. So, you know, I think dissatisfaction and suffering can come in various forms. And like I said, it really depends on how you see and how you have to look deep in yourself what that is. But, you know, in general, you know, the classic breakdown is, you know, there is physical suffering, there is mental suffering. However you want to categorize it, emotional, financial, whatever you have, there is always some degree of dissatisfaction. And like I said, there is a spectrum. I mean, if you're, the very obvious ones, you're sick, you have a fever, you have a runny nose, you have a stuffed nose, you can't breathe, that's suffering. That's discomfort. Yeah? That's, you can feel it. It's very obvious. You don't need to go into deep meditation and, yeah, I've got problems. You feel it, right? Yeah, I can't breathe. My soup is tasteless, I'm sick. That's pretty obvious. And mentally, you know, we have our stresses, we have our discomforts, and exams are coming. I haven't studied. I don't know what to expect. My parents are probably going to kill me if I don't pass. I'm an international student. My parents are paying my full fees. I'm just getting pass. I haven't gotten credit, much less to say high distinction. Stress. And sort of later on, when you graduate, when you start working, different kinds of stress. You finally got a house. My gosh, the mortgage is just, I don't know how I'm going to pay mortgage. And then financial security, things like that. These are pretty, it's not really tangible, but like it's things that you feel firsthand. It's very real to you. But let's just refine that even a bit more. Like when you were meditating just now, how long was the meditation?
25 minutes.
See, I told Coco I'll be late, so I said, meditate longer. So that I appear like I come on time. So, Anyone want to share with me your 25 minutes of sitting still in a dark room, closed eyes, sitting on a hard chair on a Friday night when everyone else is partying? Just, you know, anyone want to share your quick sharing of your experience with that 25 minutes of meditation?
I think if it was just that would have been great, but my head was like, negative things.
Precisely, isn't it? That's right. Because, you know, the first 2 minutes of Coco saying, okay, everybody, sit still, close your eyes, keep your back upright, take in some deep breaths. First breath, feels good. Second breath, yeah. Third breath, I'm hungry. And then the instructions stop. And then you're left in limbo. And then you're like, okay, I think I'll just keep breathing. You know, after that, it's like, within McDonald's. Breathing out, go shopping. Breathing in. Yeah, this chair is so hard. Breathing out. My legs are itchy. Breathing in, very thirsty. Breathing out. How long has it been? You know, you want to sit still. You would like your mind to be calm, but you can't really control your mind, isn't it? Like you said, it just keeps going around. Like you don't really have full control over it, isn't it? You know, okay, come back, breath. By the third breath, something else comes in. Third breath is pretty good. Sometimes by mid-breath already, something else comes in. Right? So there is that constant sense of shifting, unease. It just keeps going. So these are very subtle, but it's still a sense of, you know, shakiness. You're not still. You're not at peace. There is still always something that the mind wants to grab hold of, or wants to chase after, or wants to push away. You know, you suddenly remember, yeah, I owe that guy $200. Okay, don't think. He doesn't see me, he can't remember. Then the next breath, oh my gosh, yeah. Keeps coming back and forth. So even though you're physically quite comfortable, it's a cool aircon room. I know this afternoon it's pretty hot, but now it's, you know, the sun has set, we're in an air-conditioned room. But still the mind is not at peace. Still going around in circles. It's subtle, but it's there, right? So I mean, why do we get the expression, why do we feel bored? If everything's, you know, the weekend, nothing much is happening, you have no responsibilities, no homework, but you sit at home and then you're like, I'm bored. I want to do something. It's very boring. I want to go swimming. I want to go to a cafe. The room is too hot, too stuffy. And it's just that always, you know, the mind is just not very well settled. I mean, we'll eventually get there if we practice hard enough. But to the layperson like you and I, this is very real. This is uneasiness. This is, again, a sense of dissatisfaction. So that's why I think it's important that when we talk about seeking refuge, we need to recognize the problem. And then we want to get out of this problem, which is this sense of uneasiness. I don't think you absolutely need to be able to get rid of all your, say, financial problems if you seek refuge in a triple gem. But, you know, at least your mind can have some form of stability. Good. Now that we have defined what is refuge and we have defined what our problem is, next question is, who do you seek refuge from? Have you ever thought about that? That, yeah, when you're young, if you're in a Buddhist country, or, you know, you're culturally the place is very Buddhist. You're like, yeah, my mother said let's go to temple and you know take refuge from Triple Gem. Okay, yeah. Have you taken refuge? Yeah. I took refuge. No problems. Refuge done. Sorted. It's like, is that how refuge is really seen from a spiritual perspective? Probably not. So again, who do you seek refuge from? Because I think, say if you have a, you know, most of you are uni students, right? Most of you. Yeah. You'll be doing some course. I don't know what course you do. Maybe economics, maybe accounts, maybe law, maybe medicine, business, architect, whatever. But in your course, every day you have some kind of tutorials, you have questions to do, you go to lectures, etc., right? Say, okay, Tas. Sorry, I know Tas. Say if you have a, Tas is doing medicine, right? Yeah. Which year are you in again?
Third year,
yeah. So one day, Tas goes to a tutorial, and then he has a problem with, say, I don't know, what's the most recent problem that you've come across? In uni. I don't want to know about your boyfriend, girlfriend.
Medicine specific topic.
So has so. No questions.
Medicine specific topic.
Yeah.
But, okay. It's probably about like the one I asked you before. Remember? So that was my most recent problem. So it's like a pain in the back.
Okay.
Whether it's act radiating to
right.
Where,
yeah. So he has a problem about, you know, back pain, medical question. Is he going to ask an economics tutor about back pain problems? Right? Is he going to ask a design tutor about back pain problems? No. If you want a proper answer to your question, you seek the expert in that area, right? Right? Like someone who studied that, who's mastered it, who's an expert in that area. Then they can solve your problems properly. Does that make sense? Yeah. So we have to have some idea of, you know, okay, we have all these problems in our hearts and minds. We are sometimes troubled, we are sometimes at ease. If I want to be relieved from this, I need to seek help from an expert in this area. I think back in 2,500 years ago, I don't think there's a specialist field called psychologist or psychiatrist, right? So, anyways, you want to seek, you know, the right expert in the right area, okay? So, let's just explore a few sort of avenues where sometimes people think it can bring them peace and happiness. Because if that answers their question, then they're likely to seek refuge there, isn't it? So, I read this book by Venerable Ying Shun. He's one of the quite prominent Mahayanist monk, and he's written quite a few very good books about Buddhism. But of course, his background is from a Mahayana background. But nonetheless, his teachings are still very valid. And in this book called The Path to Buddhahood, okay, I'm sure there's copies of English versions in Unibuds Library. You don't know, right?
There is. Yeah.
There is. Good. At least someone goes to the library. So worldly people like you and I, right, tend to put their hopes and ambitions in sort of these roughly six categories of things that they think might provide happiness. The first thing is money. Wealth. If I have money, if I have money, I'll pay off my mortgage. If I have money, I'll pay off my uni fees, no problems. If I have money, I'll go shopping every day. So it becomes like your goal and ambition. And it becomes something that you, if you put your trust into it, then that is a problem. I'm not saying that don't get money. It's still the way of the world. But you know, everyone transacts in sort of money and some form of currency. So it'd be ridiculous if you say, yeah, I don't need money altogether. you live in a forest, sure. But I think as a common day-to-day, everyday living, money is important, yes. But do we put our... But will it bring peace and calmness to our hearts and mind? Probably not. Right? How many economic students here? One. Just one. Not bad, not bad. Does money ever appreciate or depreciate naturally? Naturally by like, I mean, you have money in the bank. Does it tend to appreciate or depreciate?
Depends on the economy.
Very good. I like that answer. Very non-committal answer. But generally, okay, depends on the economic state. Over the last 100 years, do you think we're appreciating or depreciating? Okay, I don't know either. But every day it seems like the cost of everything is going up, but our salary is not increasing. But let's say, you know, you take the most cautious ways with your money. Varenbo has still mentioned there's a few things that can happen that you don't really have control of. Some of those things he's mentioned are like natural disasters. Floods, fire, theft, and in here it says tyrants. We probably don't have evil kings, but we still have sort of, you know, governments, and I'm not saying that they're corrupt, but say if, as a whole, if something goes horribly wrong with, let's say, certain policies or world economies, things like that, these things are really beyond your own control. You don't have full control. I mean, the value of money can change. Yesterday's US dollar is one versus how much US Aussie dollar. Today is a different value. Like the value is just inconsistent. And in the book, it also says unfilial children, you know, you leave an inheritance, they may squander it off. So what it's trying to say is money is not the be all and all for your problems, right? The next thing, status, social status, position. Right? And I guess in this day and age, it's even more prominent that it's a false sense of security. I think when Facebook first came out, you'd be defined by how many likes you get. This post is 1,000 likes, what? Yours 500 likes. Relative status that's defined by Facebook. But it's still pretty artificial. But other things, you know, I wrote here even in Buddhist stories, but I can't remember what now. But you can see from a lot of lessons from history, you know, different people rise up to a position of power, but within overnight, everything is just... Say, for example, Hitler. Okay. At one point, he was a very prominent leader among the Nazis, right? And then, you know, when the regime collapsed and all that, sort of he's not remembered as a highly respected person or whatever. This like this social status, they keep changing depending on lots of conditions. They're not stable. They're not your be all and all to the answers to your unsatisfactoriness and unease. The other thing he's mentioned is close relationships. I think we can relate to this a bit more. We often put our hopes and our happiness in our relationship with family, friends, communities. But if you inspect this one, this fluctuates quite a fair bit. I mean, they don't always change for bad. They can be from bad to good, but they can also fluctuate from good to bad and vice versa. I know we don't have, most of you here are not married and don't have kids, but I know there are at least some parents in the audience. Your relationship with your children or your relationship with your parents, right? Like, if mom gives me some allowance, yes, I love mom. Best mom, best dad. Yeah. And then when the allowance, like only half of what was promised, oh, man, mom, dad. what's going on? Why do you do this to me? Sure, it may not become like hate, but that's sort of, you can see what I'm trying to get at. Like that intensity, that relationship sort of fluctuates as well. Okay, and you make friends along the way. You sometimes make enemies along the way. But sometimes your closest friends have become your worst enemies. So again, these things keep changing. You know? And yeah. The next thing that is mentioned in this book that I couldn't quite translate very well is but I think what he's trying to get at is that we tend to think that we will live forever. I think it's this notion that we will live forever. Even though every day, you know, we know that, yeah, we're getting old. It applies to everyone else but me. Everyone else will get old but me. Someone else will get sick but me. I mean, it's, we think naturally as human beings, we tend to have this kind of idea. And again, obviously this is a false ideation. We will get sick. And one day we will all pass on. The other thing that we tend to put our hopes, ambitions, and beliefs in is the country. I think he probably meant it in that, you know, again, if you, you know, political parties can change and your personal safety is not quite guaranteed all the time. Everything could be good now, but who knows, maybe we go to war. We can't control country, political party as, you know, Egypt, like as a whole. And the last thing that he's mentioned is often people put their ideas in society, and I think he meant maybe in like the continuation of society or continuation of culture. Like, you know, it doesn't matter if I disappear, as long as my Chinese culture carries on, my whatever culture carries on. I think in this process, they think that the individual does not matter. But then, as a whole, you know, these things are, again, affected by so many conditions. And it continues to ebb and, you know, what's the word? Ebb and it goes up and down. Yeah. I mean, just look at certain civilizations. We find them buried in sand dunes and things like that. But once these were the crown jewels of their society, they were flourishing and things like that, but they're now completely in ruins. There's nothing left of it, except for what archaeologists have found. So if you want it to last longer, maybe you need to build some, you know, big stone monument so that it can last a bit longer. And so these are the six things that he mentioned in his book that worldly people like you and I tend to put our hopes in, which is not quite permanent. They'll keep changing. And I'll just briefly cover these other things that maybe not all of you will understand, because it's a little bit cultural and it's a little bit sort of supernatural. Putting your hopes and absolute refuge in gods and ghosts. In the Buddhist cosmology, there is many different gods, not just one god. It's a bit different to the Christian concept of God. There are many, 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 many gods. Many gods. Okay? And there are also spirits, ghosts, etc., 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 depending on which culture you're from. Some ghosts are harmful, some ghosts are more like spirits, they're around to, they're just other types of people. But in the Buddhist cosmology, they are still trapped within the cycle of life and death. They haven't fully gotten rid of their own afflictions and their own problems either. So, I heard this story from a friend that, you know, he mentioned that one of the monks told him that there is this, you know, god who is a sworn protector of Buddhism. You know, if you're in trouble, you shout his name, he will come and magically he will help you out. But when he sort of told this story to another monk, so this monk was wise enough and he said, don't forget, this God is still part of, you know, the cycle of life and death. They have their own affliction still, depending on their mood. If they're in a bad mood, if they just fought with their spouse, I don't know if they have wives or kids or not. They just had a fight, they're not in a good mood. Maybe they can't hear you. Maybe they just don't want to show up because they're in a bad mood. Because they're still in the cycle of life and death. They have their own troubles as well. So gods and ghosts are not the ideal objects for refuge as well. And Venerable continues to talk on a few different types of levels of heavens, but again, the bottom line is it's still trapped within the cycle of life and death. And just briefly mentioning this, he actually mentioned that one of the highest levels of heaven is not, it's very not ideal, because in the Buddhist cosmology, in order to go up to higher realms of existence, you do have to accumulate certain amounts of merit, like good deeds. You can't just suddenly go from, you know, you've done evil all your life and then suddenly one day, very good, you just go up to the highest level of heaven where you have all the luxuries you want. No, it's not quite possible. So you do accumulate sort of your good merits and so on. But then when you're reborn in these very high levels of heaven, there is a problem because they think they are enlightened. And their lifespans are extremely long. And so, they spend their lives enjoying themselves, not really practicing the way to end their suffering. So then it's kind of like a waste of time, is what he's trying to say. But I thought it's just interesting to share with you, because I think sometimes, you know, that bit is not quite mentioned. But just take it with a grain of salt. But, you know, it's just something that you may come across depending on which sects of Buddhism we come across. Anyways, so I think we established that there is dissatisfaction. We want to end this dissatisfaction. Therefore, we want to seek someone to seek refuge from that can help us end this dissatisfactions and problems. And we've just gone through a whole bunch of things that's not ideal for seeking refuge. So, who can we seek refuge from? You are here in a Buddhist Dharma talk, so I think the answer is quite obvious. We'll be seeking refuge from the Buddha, his teachings, and the community of monks. So we like to refer to them as the Triple Gems. And I'm sure most of you already know, because almost all of you have attended many, many, many Buddhist talks before. Now, can I ask the general audience, like, have you heard of other Buddhas? Mm. Yes? Mm. Yes? Has anyone not heard of the existence of other Buddhas? Yeah? One? Anyone else? Two? Yep? Okay? Good. Alright. Good. Then I have something to talk about. We'll finish this talk in the next 10 minutes. Okay. Either way, for the benefit of those who haven't heard, so in Buddhism, often there is talk of different kinds of Buddhas. There is the Amitabha Buddha, there is the Medicine Buddha, some of the scriptures says that there are 84,000 Buddhas, countless, countless, countless Buddhas. You want a specific problem, you go and ask the Buddha. You want problems with your health, I go and ask Medicine Buddha. You want to have problems with, you have questions regarding wisdom, you go and ask the wisdom-related Buddha. So, but I still find it's very interesting and very grounding that Venerable Ingshu actually talked about when we want to seek refuge, we want to seek refuge from our current Buddha, which is Sakyamuni Buddha. And I'll explain why. Well, he explained why, that I will then read out to you. First of all, we want to seek refuge from the Buddha. Because he is a fully enlightened being. He has practiced, he has understood, and he has perfected his practice. Therefore, he has got no afflictions, and he's got no further sorrows. He is fully enlightened. Alright? So like I said, if you want to answer your problems, you have to go and seek the right teacher who has both the expertise and actually gone through it and understood and perfected for himself. So I think in our context, there's no one better than our current Buddha. Okay. And I find that it's very, very interesting, but also very grounding in that. Because Sakyamuni Buddha was in fact born on our current earth. Right? Again, in Buddhist cosmology, there are many, 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 many different types of worlds. Different world, different teachings, different beings. Some of the teachings are meant for higher beings, up there in the Dragon Palace. I don't know where, I cannot see it, but it's somewhere there. Some of the teachings are meant for hell beings, lower realms, burning, and pain. Somewhere there. I cannot see, I cannot feel, I cannot touch. But this current Buddha is born in, his historical record says he's born on earth. He was an actual person who walked this earth. He had the same troubles as us when before he became the Buddha, right? He had pain, sorrow, lamentation, etc. Yes, you have a question?
You said that we're not supposed to seek help from any gods or ghosts, but why do we seek help from the current Buddha? He is one of the gods.
So in current Buddhist practice, we don't actually refer to Buddha as a god. We refer to the Buddha as someone who has actually perfected the practice. He's an enlightened person, okay? And he's a teacher. He's a teacher that we can look towards and learn from.
Yeah. So he's an enlightened person.
He's an enlightened person. That's right. So again, I was saying that Sakyamuni Buddha was born on Earth. He walked the same planet as we did. Right? He was born as a human. He wasn't born a fish. He wasn't born a horse. He spoke words like you and I did. Okay? Language is different. Okay? But, he was a human being. So his teachings, and from age of 35 to 80 after he's attained enlightenment, he walked around teaching people like you and I. Okay, if you read the scriptures, right, if you read the suttas, who does he teach to? Okay, he spoke to farmers, he spoke to kings, he spoke to other monks, he spoke to beggars, he spoke to, barbers. He spoke to everyday people like you and I, right? So I find that this is a very powerful thing because we can actually relate to what he's teaching, okay? And I'll talk about that a little bit more. But because of this, we can refer to the Buddha. We would like to seek refuge from the Buddha because we can relate to him because he's a perfectly enlightened person. And part of the formulation as well is we would like to seek refuge to the Dharma, which is his teachings. There's no point just seeking refuge with him. Oh, Buddha, Buddha, please help me. But if we don't practice it, his teaching, and it's incomplete. And we would also like to seek refuge to the Sangha, or the community of monks and nuns who have continued to practice. And I think in many ways, they are a lot more experienced than you and I as lay people. In terms of the Buddhist practice. So we would like to seek refuge from the Triple Gems. Okay? Now, when we seek refuge, we would like to have a certain degree of faith. And again, I find this is very powerful because in Buddhist faith, we don't talk about blind faith. Right? Faith is sometimes also in translated. I think the word is sadda. It's from Pali or Sanskrit or those languages. You'll find variations of the spelling, 1D without the H, something like that. But sadda, I think, is sometimes also translated as confidence. So it's not just, this is my teachings, believe in me, no problems. Okay? It's more than that. Okay? And it encompasses again, the teachings from these other great monks are that you, through the development of faith, you actually need to listen and understand, get exposed to the Buddhist teachings, whether that's Dharma talks, books, whatever. Learn about the Dharma. And then you contemplate on it. So it's not just, the Buddha says, la 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 la, okay, I've learned the Dharma. What have you learned? What is your understanding of it? Not enough. You need to contemplate on what is actually taught. Okay? And then, you actually need to practice. The Buddha said 5 precepts, for example. No killing, no stealing, no sexual misconduct, no lying, no intoxication, no intoxicants. Oh yeah, I'll just have my beer. I'll just shoot up this drug. Doesn't quite match, right? The practice and the teachings don't match. You need to practice what is taught through your contemplation. And then you see for yourself that it actually works for you. Right? When did some of the monks come to give a talk? When was the last time?
Prism Fair week?
Pramana, is it?
Pramana.
And before that?
Venerable Nero Shifu.
Did anyone attend the talk by Pramana in Unibuds the last time? I think it was, 2 weeks ago?
Yes.
Yeah? Did anyone not attend? Okay, no, that's alright. Because I was just trying to give an example that when monks come to give a talk, especially if they're from a Theravadan background, we tend to do a bit of chanting, isn't it? Has anyone not heard of the Buddhist chants before, especially the salutations to the Triple Gems? Bhagavata, Dhammo. Anyways, there are lots of copies of the chanting in the Univats library, and I do encourage you to just have a look at it. There's English translations, but I want to point out one word, which is called ehipasiko in Pali. And it is translated as see for yourself. Come and see for yourself. And I think this is a very powerful word. Powerful word. Because it's not just, this is the Buddhist teaching, this is what I said, recite it 100 times, you'll be fine. No, it says, ehi pasiko, come and see for yourself. Come, listen, practice, and see it for yourself. So it's not just blind faith that we're doing in taking refuge. All right, there is a process. Okay. I mean, don't worry too much of the absolute rituals or whatnot, but seeking true refuge, you have to listen, contemplate, practice, and then develop with faith and confidence through that process. Right? Why did I write this? Let me see. Right. In one of the suttas called the Dhammaki Sutta, this is what the Buddha said. On observing that the monk is purified with regard to qualities based on delusion, he places conviction in him. With the arising of conviction, he visits him and grows close to him. Growing close to him, he lends ear, listening. Lending ear, he hears the Dharma. Hearing the Dharma, he remembers it. Remembering it, he penetrates the meaning of those Dharmas, i.e. contemplating. Penetrating the meaning, he comes to an agreement through pondering the Dharmas. There being an agreement through pondering the Dharmas, desire arises. With the arising of desire, he becomes willing. Willing, he contemplates. Contemplating, he makes an exertion. Exerting himself, he both realizes the ultimate meaning of the truth with his body and sees by penetrating it with discernment. I think this pretty much covers what I just said. And this is from one of the suttas. Again, if you want the resources, I'm more than happy to pass it to you. So then we kind of, and at this point I'll just bring out another sutta called the Kalama Sutta. Has anyone heard of Kalama Sutta? Okay. That's fine. So, the summary of this sutta basically is that Kalama is like a tribe of people, like this group of people back in those days, one kingdom or, you know, like one group, okay. And they have, I suppose they have strong traditions of passing on certain teachings, certain things that they say, certain rituals, certain way of doing things, okay? But the Buddha came around and said that okay, I might just read this out because we've got some time. He said, he asked Kalamas, the group Kalamas, "What do you think, Kalamas? When lack of greed arises in a person, does it arise for welfare or for harm?" Lack of greed. When lack of greed arises. He says, for welfare. "And this ungreedy person, not overcome by greed, his mind not possessed by greed, doesn't kill living beings, doesn't take what is not given, doesn't tell lies, doesn't induce others to do bad things. Is this for long-term welfare and happiness?" Yes. "What do you think, Kalamas? When lack of aversion arises in a person, does it arise for welfare or for harm?" Lack of aversion. Aversion is like pushing away, right? So if there's a lack of aversion, you know, does it arise for welfare or for harm? Like for welfare. "And this unaversive person, not overcome by aversion, his mind not possessed by aversion, doesn't kill living beings, etc., etc. Is this for long-term welfare and happiness?" Yes. "And what do you think, Kalamas? When lack of delusion arises in a person, is it for good or bad?" Again, the formulation repeats. Okay. So as I said, Kalamas, don't go by reports, by legends, by traditions, by scripture, by logical conjecture, by inference, by analogies, by agreement through pondering views, by probability, or by the thought that this is our teacher, when we know for yourself that these qualities are skillful, these qualities are blameless, these qualities are praised by the wise, these qualities, when adopted or carried out, lead to welfare and happiness. Then you should enter and remain in them. Guess what he's trying to say is, don't just go by reports, don't just go by legends, by traditions, by what people just hear, say, and continue on. But if the action itself are skillful, they are blameless, and they are praised by the wise, they lead to welfare and happiness, then should you continue in them. This is essentially saying, don't just go by blind faith. Don't just go by because it's said by the Buddha, because it's said by me, because it's said by someone that this must be good. Right? You have to try, and if these things are indeed wise and leads to happiness, then keep them. If not, it doesn't matter if it's tradition or what have you. If they're not beneficial, maybe something should change. However, I would like to point out a caveat because, you know, because I think often when we see this, then the other flip side of it is we can fall into ego very easily, like, oh yeah, that's it, you know, I think this is good for me, therefore, you know, I'll just do it, like, it's good for me, so it must be good. So, one of the translators by Bhikkhu Tamisaro was saying that, any view or belief must be tested by the results it yields when put into practice, and to guard against the possibility of any bias or limitations in one's understanding of those results, they must further be checked against the experience of people who are wise. Okay? So there's a bit of a qualifying statement. You know. Sure, we may think this is good, but check. Just check with someone else. I think often when we're very isolated, we do things our own way, you know. Nothing, everything seems right, but maybe in fact it's not so right. Do you know that in the community of monks, they have range retreats? Yes? And they're called Vasa, but irregardless, for a proper range retreat to happen. So range retreat are when, back in the Buddha's day, there is a certain period of time in the year where the climate is very rainy, it's very, it's unconducive for them to go around for arms round and things like that. So they stay in one place and they do intensive practice. So, you know, actually this is how some the monks sort of address each other by seniority, by how many vasas, how many range retreats they've actually gone through. Okay? Why did I say this? That's right. But it's not good enough to just lock yourself in a room during the range retreat for the 3 months and then it's like, yes, I've completed one vasa. There is actually rules in their monastic codes that in order to claim that this is a proper range retreat, a vasa, they need to have at least five monks in that place, practicing together. Because when you have other people around you, not necessarily a big group, but when you have other people around you, then you can check. You know, you're not suddenly like, yeah, I think I'm enlightened, but I hate you, man. But if you're not, if the person's not there, it's like, yeah, I think I'm enlightened. Cool. Everything's cool. And then come out day one out of brain's retreat, man, this bowl sucks. So I think again this is very important because you always need to check with someone. And you know, don't just check with someone who's random. You have to check with someone who's wise, who's actually done the practice. And often I encourage people when learning Buddhism to actually ask questions to monks and nuns. In fact, sometimes I'm a bit hesitant coming to give talks. I feel that I am not very well practiced, which is why I tend to go back to sutras. But I still think that, you know, it's important to always counter-check with wise people, especially monks and nuns. If we compare ourselves with monks and nuns, I think they spend, you know, we spend 8 hours a day at work. You spend, I don't know, 5-6 hours a day at uni and another 5 hours going through assignments. How much time in your day have you dedicated to proper spiritual practice? Not a lot, right? But I think as monks and nuns, that's what they do day in, day out. So, you know, from an expertise and experience level, I think they've probably gone through a lot more than what we have. So it's good to always counter-check with them. So, I've said all these. So far, any questions? Let me get a drink.
Can you say wise person, you mean monks and nuns, not just somebody that thinks he's wise?
Look, I think the absolute judge of if someone is wise is hard. But I think as a general rule, as a general thing, I would think that most monks and nuns, I can't say for all, because at the end of the day, the practice of the person is very weak. You can have this person who just become a monk and nun for one day. Yesterday he was your friend, today he's now, you all mucking around together, and today he's a monk and nun. Clearly his experience is not very different than yours. And I think, I especially quite like the Chinese saying by Confucian that out of three people that you go with together, there will be something that you can learn from them. You pick up the bad habits and you don't learn from them, as in you know to avoid those, and you pick up the good qualities from someone and you learn from them. So there will always be your teachers around. But I suppose, as a general thing, those people who have practiced more are generally, you know, quite well practiced. I tend to ask questions to people more senior than me, you know, because they've got a lot more life experience than I have, and they generally have learned, you know, Buddhism for much longer than I have too as well. So I think there's no harm in having a chat with them, trying to find out a bit more, and then just counter-checking your actions. You know, what do you think? What do you wrote? But of course, I think there are some baselines that, you know, we really should cross. And I think they're quite well outlined by the five precepts. No killing, no stealing, no sexual misconduct, no lying, no intoxicants. Yeah. Does that sort of help answer your question? Yeah. So, by now, you'll be like, man, we came here and the topic says one is one's own refuge. And this speaker is that we should seek refuge in the triple gems. this off topic. And at this point, I would say that, and there's always this analogy in Buddhism, which is the Buddha's teachings are like your medicine, but you have to take it. I'm a doctor. I write prescriptions every day, but I can't take the medications for my patients. I will die first. Alright? The person needing the medication still has to take it for themselves. If you have back pain, I will give you painkillers, and then I'll try and find out why you have back pain, and then we'll try and address the root of the problem. But you have to take the medicine, right? I can't take it for you. I don't have back pain. Yeah. And that's why I think I go back to the first point, which is also the first noble truth, that there is a cause, there is dissatisfaction. We still have to see that there is a problem. Now that we know this, that there are solutions, and then we have to take it for ourselves. Alright? But this is not just, yeah, like I said, you need to counter check your actions, and you need to be guided still. And I'll read out this final quote from the sutta that I have prepared for tonight, which is the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, which is sort of the biggest, longest, and also the final sutta of the Buddha's life. He has a personal attendant, which is Ananda, also a monk, and this is literally at his deathbed. Death. So, Ananda, be your own island, your own refuge, with no other refuge. Let the teaching be your island and your refuge, with no other refuge. And how does a practitioner do this? It's when a practitioner meditates by observing an aspect of body, feelings, mind, and principles, which is essentially he's pointing out to the four foundations of mindfulness. You know, be rid of desire and aversion for the world. That's how a practitioner is their own island, their own refuge with no other refuge. That's how the teaching is their island and their refuge with no other refuge. Whether now or after I have passed, any of my practitioners who shall live as their own island, their own refuge with no other refuge, with the teaching as their island and their refuge with no other refuge, shall be among the best of the best, any who want to train. So it's not just, yeah, I'll go do my own thing, you know, I've listened to enough Dharma talks, I know what it's all about, I'll just go and do my own thing. I am my own refuge. The speaker said, I have to depend on myself, I have to put in the effort, and then you go and do some weird thing. It says quite clearly, I think no matter how you interpret it, I think the Buddha with his final breaths has said that be your own refuge, yes, and be your own refuge, and let the teaching be your island and your refuge. So it has to be in line and be guided by the Buddha's teachings. So not just, I am my own refuge, I will do my thing. It has to be guided by the Buddha's teachings. Cool? So, yeah. So I think that's about what I have prepared for you tonight. I think just as a quick summary, I think we've talked about what is refuge. We've talked about that there are problems. The first of which, we have to recognize that there is a problem. Again, if there's no problem, there's no need for solution. We recognize that there is a problem, and we seek the experts who are in this area, the Triple Gems, and not just blindly following, but learning, contemplating, practicing, and then from there you gain confidence in the Triple Gems. But at the end of it, we have to take that on board and practice for ourselves, together in keeping with the Buddhist teachings. So I think that's how you can, or we can, be one, us, as our own refuge.
What?
Finished early mark. Good. That's all I have prepared for tonight, and I'm open to questions or comments if anyone wants to say anything that's a bit unclear, or I'll be like, yeah, we're all invited. Woo! Hi. Yep.
Do you think that because in the beginning we were kind of talking about the causes of suffering, or like there is something causes of suffering, and it comes back to like ourselves, so we kind of like our own enemy as well. And so, do you think that kind of has something to do with why a lot of people, even like practicing Buddhists, tend to look for some else outside of them?
Yeah, I mean, I often find that in the Buddhist practice, it's very interesting, because at first there's no problems, but as you practice more, you get more problems. But I see that as a good thing. Why? Because initially you have no idea, absolutely no idea. Every day is just every day, you know. I wake up, brush my teeth, I have breakfast, I go to uni, I go to work, blah blah blah, I come home, watch TV, eat dinner, sleep. But as you start to learn more about Buddhism, and as you start to dwell a bit deeper into your own heart and mind, you'll be like, oh yeah, actually I have a lot of anger. Yeah. And you'll be like, oh yeah, actually I have a lot of uneasiness. I'm not happy, you start seeing things. You start to see the subtleties. You start to see your emotions. I'm not saying that you get carried away by them, but these things start to become a bit more apparent. They're more obvious. So, I actually attended this meditation course before, and this is exactly my own experience. The first few sittings, it feels harder and harder and harder, because the analogy is, Now you start to see the roadblocks. Before, you haven't even noticed that there were roadblocks. But now as you practice more, you start seeing the roadblocks. That's why it becomes harder. And then as you practice more, then you start to overcome these roadblocks. So yes, there is probably this process that at one point you get very frustrated. You're always your own enemy, because you're like, how can I have so much troubles? How can I have so much anger, greed, hatred? But if you look at it this way, that, hey, I'm actually starting to see them now. Whereas before, I was just running on autopilot. I was just reacting. But now, I'm starting to see this. And then as you practice even more, you're able to drop this. Let go of them. You don't act on them. And then you start to overcome these roadblocks. And finally, of course, I don't know how long it takes, but then you're at peace and at ease with yourself. You finally manage to let go of them. Let go of these problems, these afflictions, this greed, hatred, and delusion. And you're less troubled. You're happy. Yeah. I hope that sort of touches on your point. Yeah? Yeah. Yes?
Going on to what you said before about seeing the roadblocks and being more mindful and aware of yourself in terms of your afflictions. What's the next step after you realize, say, I have a lot of anger, sadness, dissatisfaction within myself?
So I think it's quite helpful if you can find out the cause of it. I always like to go back to the Four Noble Truths. There is a problem, there is a cause, there is an end, and there is a way. So sometimes there are events and specific things that trigger these things. Sometimes you just have to apply the right kind of antidotes to those current problems. For example, I think some of the well-practiced teachers, they often advise that if you have a lot of anger, the antidote is usually patience or loving kindness. I quite like the practice of patience first, because often when you're angry, you're quite impatient. And you know, to go from being angry to suddenly like, may all beings be one. It's a bit hard. It's a bit of a, you know, like a big U-turn. It's quite hard. But I think if you sort of apply the first practice of, okay, let me just count to 10. And then let that sort of emotion settle a bit. And then you can slowly then start bringing in loving kindness and things. So sometimes we have to find the right kind of antidotes to the specific emotional states. And I mentioned that sometimes there are specific events that trigger, but at the end of it, you can't really control these events. It still comes back to what's inside. But of course, to practice that first, you know, I mean, as an analogy, if you're in a burning house, you're not going to be like, yeah, you know, I'll be at peace in it. It's like, get out of the burning house first, right? Like, you, like initially, you have to solve the most prominent and most obvious problems. And I know that's why it's hard. And I think that's why it's, you know, that's why this world is imperfect. There will always be something that comes along. But if we can start to recognize what's our roadblock inside, then we can try and apply the right antidotes. Yeah, and it's not easy. And I mean, I'll give you, I always find Buddhist stories very inspiring because they are records of what happened, even to the prominent monks and nuns, even in the Buddha's time. I don't know if you've heard of Venerable Sariputta and Moggallana. Yeah? They are the two foremost disciples of the Buddha. Like, one is foremost in wisdom and one is foremost in, you know, his meditation and psychic abilities. Right? But before they were, you know, these two great disciples, they actually struggled a lot with their own meditation practice. In fact, if you try and Google, because there's just so many suttas, right? How are you going to filter through all of them? So I just Google the keywords and then I go back to the main sutta. I still go back to the main sutta, I give you that. But he sort of gave instructions because this disciple, he was always falling asleep during meditation. Always falling asleep. Yeah. And he was frustrated by that too, right? He wanted to practice, he wanted to continue. So the Buddha actually gave him a series of instructions. At first, you know, you might want to, if you're really, he did say that if you're really, really very tired, like physically and mentally tired, just rest, sleep first. Otherwise, you know, try shifting a position, try imagining a bright light. Because, you know, things that sort of inspire and sort of motivate a bit more. Imagine a bright light, and if all that's failing, you're still falling asleep, open your eyes, you know, look at something bright. And if that's still failing, he gave next steps and next steps to the point the last one, I think, was, you know, sit at the edge of the river. I mean, you read it, it's there. So even the foremost disciples of the Buddha met these challenges. We are much less practiced. I think we can accept our challenges as, you know, as beginners, we will come across a lot of challenges. But yeah, so we start small and then we eventually get there. But yes, I think, you know, recognizing the roadblocks and then putting in the right effort to counteract those things, yeah, eventually come. Good question, thank you. Anything else? Confused? Yes?
You mentioned that, so if we have a problem, so say for example we're very aware that we're feeling, I don't know, angry or sad, right? And like, so the step before that and getting an antidote is to find the correct root of that problem to be able to use the correct antidote to solve that problem, right? So what if you can't find the root of that problem? Do you just keep finding, or do you...
I often find that, I mean, the initial step would still be to try and if there is a fire, you try and put out the fire first, right? Like, it has to be managed somewhat, to a certain degree first. If you have such immense hatred, for example, you still need to sort of walk away from the situation, try and calm yourself down and things like that. So I think there is that initial step. I don't know about you, but I find that if you actually pay enough attention and you are able to have some degree of peace and clarity, often the cause will come out, like it's from inside. Like you will be able to find it. May not be immediate. You know, sometimes you just suddenly, maybe 2-3 days down the track, you'll be like, oh yeah, actually I was pretty upset by what that guy told me the other day. Oh yeah, that's right. So you know, I still think that at some point you will still find the cause. But I think again a lot of patience, because some things are obvious and some things are just not very obvious. And some things, like our mind works in mysterious ways. I can't even begin to claim that I know my mind very well. But yeah, there's a lot of things from memories, your own thoughts. You know, initially this memory was something small, and then you add some sugar and pepper, and then it's like, oh my gosh, the image that you finally come up is very different. And I remember there was one of the meditation practitioners was telling me that one day he was sitting in meditation. He's like 70 years old, and it's like one day just out of the blue, like this jingle from an advertisement he saw as a kid, like just suddenly just came up. Pretty random, but okay. So just look at it and let it go. Just live with all that. Sorry, I don't think I've managed to touch on your answer directly, but I think with enough peace and clarity, the end, they will renew themselves. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes.
I think can I cap on to the solutions? Can, is it there a possible way that when you when you mention this problem to your friends or more wisdom person, then during the conversation you start to realize what you really want.
Yeah, so bouncing your ideas off someone else. That's, you know, I think there are many ways. There are many ways. You still have to find something that suits you as well. Because what might work for you may not work for me, vice versa. Yeah. Okay. Happy? Confused? Tired? Hungry? Sleepy? I have no idea what tonight's talk is about, man.